Hello, and welcome back to Album, the podcast that brings you, David Bowie, me, Arslan Mohammed, a guest, and a Zoom call, all together to illuminate a corner of the vast Bowie discography for your delight and entertainment. And today, I'm very happy to introduce you to my guest, the prolific writer, podcaster, and the hardest working man possibly in pop culture, Telly's top clangers expert, it's Tim Worthington. Tim's podcast, Looks Unfamiliar, is a favourite around these parts, a podcast in which guests talk about an esoteric kaleidoscope of long-forgotten cultural gems, many of which will tickle the most dormant neurons of anyone who recalls the golden age of 1970s or 80s TV, music, film, comics, and general pop culture. Tim's books, meanwhile, ponder at length subjects spanning BBC radio comedy, 1990s indie pop, Radio 1, Camberwick Green, and amidst the torrents of memories he shares with us in the semi-autobiographical Can't Help Thinking About Me, some fascinating ruminations on David Bowie's 1960s TV appearances and disappearances. So, given that Tim is someone who digs deep and delights in obscure detail, he chose to eschew the album format and instead pick an intriguing slice of Bowie history. The 1970 single Holy Holy, originally recorded in that weird dead period, just after the recording of The Man Who Sold the World in 1970. This was when the disillusioned Mick Ronson had returned to Hull to work as a municipal gardener, marking out rugby pitches on council playing fields instead of living it up with Bowie and the gang at Haddon Hall. David had recorded the single for his record label Philips with the guitarist Alan Parker and the bass player Herbie Flowers, and despite a very voguish cocktail of sex, black magic, Bolan-esque yodeling and yelping, and religious torment, nothing much really happened. But a year later, when a reinvigorated Ronson and the Spiders were cutting tracks for the Ziggy album, they recorded a new, spikier, amped-up version, very, very glam, for the LP. But weirdly, for some reason, Bowie dropped it from the final running order at the very last minute, and instead it crept out as the B-side to Diamond Dogs in 1974. As an interesting side note, that original 1970 version was actually slated for release in 2002 as part of the Ziggy Stardust 30th anniversary reissue, but again, Bowie vetoed it at the last minute. What was going on? This recording of the song clearly presented him with some issues. Still, finally, it came out in the 2015 Five Years box set, so everyone can listen to that version of Holy Holy with Alan Parker on guitar and Herbie Flowers on bass, and a bloke whose name I've forgotten on the drums. And you can make your own mind up about it. I mean, certainly the Ziggy version is far more fizzy and happening, but again, it didn't really take off, despite the very frantic arrangement and Mick Ronson's absolutely brilliant guitar playing. But as we'll talk about in this episode, you'll hear why the song came to be the way it was, and we throw around a few theories as to why Bowie and the band made it that way. But I just want to say that it's fitting that Tim Worthington, a man who really does delight in rediscovering and appreciating these cultural coins that have fallen down the back of the sofa of pop culture, should have chosen this song to discuss today. So come with us as Tim and I convene to travel back in time and, via David Bowie, explore the occult, Tony Visconti, the hype, Doctor Who, Mark Bolan, Beckenham, Bob Greaves, The Who, and the Silurians, to explore the strange and surreal story of Holy Holy.
Well, I was called Clangers Expert by the BBC News Channel and also Cultural Historian by Channel 5, so I'll go with both of those. I'm basically a writer, occasional broadcaster, as I describe it, because I really do writing more, mainly about When you say popular culture, people think it's quite, you know, ephemeral and fluffy and so on. I'm more interested in the history of things, how things work sociologically, how production decisions came about, things like that. Quite a lot about old films, Doctor Who, 60s pop music, which obviously, well, I know it's 1971, but, you know, here's what we're going to talk about. And I also do a couple of podcasts, one called Looks Unfamiliar, which is about basically the things that people remember that no one else ever seems to. And, you know, we cover quite a wide scope of things in that. In fact, there has been one where somebody picked When the Wind Blows by David Bowie, which, you know, is the exact sort of thing we're talking about.
Yeah. It's
a David Bowie single that's forgotten to the extent it's not even really on compilations. And another one called It's Good Except It Sucks, about the Marvel Cinematic Universe, where I try to make it as accessible as I can. I mean, I've had guests that have never seen a Marvel film before and made them watch, say, Spider-Man Homecoming and said, what do you actually think of that? If you're looking for something to listen to while you're bringing the shopping in, that's the one, really. But I've written a couple of books as well, some of which will... I think it's fair we come back to this later rather than get the plug in now, but some of them do cover Bowie to quite an extent.
One of the things I like about the way you write and about the things you do is that you tend to be on the sidelines looking in. You always tend to come up with something a bit different and something a little bit unknown.
Well, thank you for saying that, but really it just comes from what I'm interested in. It's like the analogy I always use is, in the 60s, I find Rod Stewart's singles from the 60s more interesting. I mean, they're not better, Lord knows they're not better, but more interesting than the Beatles or the Stones because you can tell more about what was happening in the 60s because he desperately wanted to be famous and he jumped on every bandwagon that was going, right the way from protest folk stuff at the start of the decade to... you know, what was becoming prog rock at the end of the decade. There's some debate, I believe, over how authentic a mod he was. You know, whether he'd just seen the scene and thought, that's something I could fit into and be a bit of an ace face and it might
Wasn't that the case with a lot of people, though, wasn't it? I mean, I read Roger Daltrey's biography some time ago. I didn't realise, I thought he was a dyed-in-the-wool committed mod, you know, like a proper modernist. And he said Pete was, but as far as Daltrey was concerned, it was about, you know, clothes and what was happening at the time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, to swing it back to David Bowie a bit, you know, how much of a committed mod was he? 6 months later, he was trying to get in with the psychedelic crowd. And, you know, how successful was that even really? Because I'm sure they regarded him as a bit of a joke. You know, as we were discussing privately the other day, you know, the fact that he has a song about a gnome. Well, who else has a song about a gnome? Pink Floyd, who on the back of Pinups, he describes going to see a lot in 66. Yeah. And, you know, they probably thought, you know, because the Laughing Gnome did get a lot of radio play, they probably thought, this bloke's nicked our idea. That's that guy that's always in the front row at the marquee. There is that thing, you are right, about people did see these things as a means to end. And that, again, really ties in with what we're going to talk about here, I think.
Well, what we're going to talk about here is Holy Holy, a song that was recorded initially at the Man Who Sold the World sessions, if I'm right. And this was recorded with a band that was not the Embryonic Spiders. But then a couple of years later, it was recorded with the Embryonic Spiders.
It's actually... as I'll come back to, a lot of the UK's top session men at the time on the 70-71 version. I think it's a really interesting pivotal point in Bowie's career that it annoys me that it never gets discussed. I mean, it wasn't even mentioned in that The First 5 Years documentary.
Was it not? It didn't even get a name check.
No, it wasn't even played in clip form. And to me, it's evidently the moment where he thought, you know, because he does have... he's got Alan Parker, Herbie Flowers, all kinds of people like that playing on it. It's not a hit. And that must be the point, if you look at what happened next, where he thought, hang on, this underground thing isn't working for me anymore. Because, you know, I'm the common factor here. I've got a song with a major record label behind it, TV exposure, loads of radio play, the best people can have playing on it, and it's not a hit. It must be me. It must be something I'm doing. And then the next step after that, obviously, is Hunky Dory. So... This is a line drawn under all of the 60s stuff and The Man Who Sold the World, which really, I mean, people laugh at me with this. That is my favourite part of his career. I'm not saying it's objectively better than Low or Ziggy Stardust or whatever, but to me, that's the more fascinating because he's trying to really jump other people's bandwagons and not quite getting it right and making something unique in the process. But this is the full stop to all of that. Holy Holy is the absolute end of that. And it's a brilliant mess of a single as well.
Let's just step back a little bit here. So you say this is your favourite period. So where was he at this point? He'd had that one-off hit single, Space Oddity, in 69, which was, I think, regarded by people like Visconti definitely as being a bit of a novelty. It was a bit of a, you know, it was a flash in the pan. So imagine you're Bowie in 1970 now. You've had that one hit, but it looks now as though things are... reverting back to that sort of endless trudge of flop singles and not knowing what direction to take.
At that point, him, Rod Stewart, who we've mentioned, Elton John, Mark Bolan and so on, they were still associated with, in inverted commas, the underground. Mm. They were part of the, you know, the kind of artists that played on John Peel. They did the festival circuit, played places like the Middle Earth. The others were only just starting to come out of that. I mean, if you look at the Rod Stewart, Elton John, and even Mark Bolan records around that time, they've got people from underground bands on them. I think Rod Stewart wrote some songs with a guy from, it was either Quintessence or Steamhammer. Some of his most famous singles from around then were co-written with, this guy's been completely forgotten now. The saxophone on Get It On is by one of King Crimson. Elton John had all his proggy mates on all his early albums, and they were stepping away from that. And Bowie was kind of still, you can never really say he was part of a scene, but it was where he was. He was deeply entrenched in that whole circuit, that whole scene, that whole part of the music papers even.
Yeah.
You know, that would have been the section he appeared in, was where they talked about, you know, these exciting up-and-coming acts, which, when you think he'd been making records for nearly a decade, and he'd had one stray hit, and he must have been thinking as well, how much longer can my luck hold out? Because obviously people thought there was potential, and they kept giving him other chances.
I've mentioned this in previous podcasts, but can you imagine today a record label, or even a number of record labels, paying for this guy who has just a, you know, long string of flops and one hit behind him, to keep developing ideas, to keep trying new things? It's quite amazing, isn't it, that he still was getting, you know, was being taken seriously, really, by the money men.
Well, yes, and there's also the whole scattershot approach of it. I mean, I don't have many positive things to say about Tony DeVries as his manager, apart from the fact that he clearly, whereas Ken Pitt, who managed him for, you know, pretty much all of the 60s, was encouraging him to try other things like, you know, the mime plays he was in. Yeah. He acted in things like Theatre 65 on BBC Two. They tried to get him a presenting slot on Jack and Ori.
No way, really?
And I would not be... Oh, yeah, that's covered in Nick Pegg's book, I think. I think it's more Ken Pitt than Bowie.
Of course I knew that, Nick.
I think it was more Ken Pitt, really. Yeah. But I have a theory. You know, there were a lot of play school presenters around the time we would have been watching who were kind of failed folkies, like Tony Arthur, Derek Griffiths, who'd been recruited from that scene. There was a time where they auditioned loads of people from the singer-songwriter clubs. And I think it's well known that Sandy Denny was auditioned, didn't get it, a couple of other people. I wouldn't be surprised if, I doubt he would have turned up for the audition, but Ken Pitt probably put Bowie's name forward for that. And some ways, the material they did in the 60s, you know,
it would totally make sense.
Same as people like Lionel Morton retooled their songs for play school,
It totally makes sense. I mean, in the most recent podcast I did just now with Chris O'Leary, we were talking about the 1967 debut and looking at Ken Pitt's role. And he's been really given, a bit of a rough deal by history, because Ken Pitt, a lot of people think, was just trying to push Bowie into cabaret and just making him do sort of, you know, very mainstream fare. Ken Pitt was the guy that came back from New York with the first Velvet Underground album. You know, Ken Pitt was the one that was encouraging him to not do Anthony Newley imitations.
You know, the only comparable thing for innovative was multimedia in that age is the Beatles, who really, they did some films, one of them wrote a book, they did some film soundtracks. That was it, whereas Bowie was doing ice cream adverts, serious plays on BBC Two.
Wasn't it Ridley Scott who directed?
Ridley Scott directed the Love advert, wasn't it?
That's amazing. Have you seen it? I think it's on YouTube.
I have, yes. Well, yes. I mean, Ridley Scott's early career is this whole fascinating thing, because, you know, he nearly designed the Daleks.
I think he had a
scheduling conflict. There were other things like there was a BBC.
I've got a scheduling conflict. I can't do Daleks.
There was a BBC show called Adam Adamant Lives about Victoria and Benjamin, who got revived in the swinging 60s. Ridley Scott directed some episodes of that. And on the documentary on the DVD, Gerald Harper recalls seeing this young man sort of ambling onto the location shoot and saying, put the camera on the floor there and point it up at Gerald in that direction.
Yeah.
And he was thinking, oh, this is interesting. And then obviously years later, you know, Ridley Scott to Ridley Scott.
Yeah,
so, you know, he was somebody who, I suppose in a way was comparable to Bowie in the 60s. He was a young director trying his hand on lots of different things. Did the Hovis advert, of course. He was trying to find what fitted as well. It was something you had to do in those days.
When did De Vries actually come on the scene? Was that 1970 or 1969?
I think it was during 1970, wasn't it? Because there was that dispute with Ken Pitt over whether the next single should be The Prettiest Star or London by Tata, which I think they made the wrong decision there. I mean, I like The Prettiest Star, but it does have a bit follow-on single syndrome to it, especially in that original version, which is quite sort of sing-along, saccharine.
Is that version with Mark Bolan on it?
Yes. It's a bit BBC Light programme as opposed to Radio 1, is the way I'd put it.
It's a bit of a clap-along. Da, 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 da. Now, let's talk a little bit about Bolan and Bowie, because obviously they were pretty close at this point. But Bolan, I mean, they were both working with Visconti. Bolan was really, you know, sort of building on his kind of, you know, space pixie persona, and he was shortly to boom with Tyrannosaurus Rex, then subsequently T-Rex. But he was definitely doing better at this time, wasn't he, than Bowie?
He was, because I think he was a bit more driven and had a bit more of a vision and wasn't afraid to get his hands dirty in terms of doing things like children's TV. I mean, if you look at a lot of it doesn't survive anymore, but a lot of the early photos of T-Rex, they're on children's programmes, which is something Bowie didn't really do. I mean, he did, as I'll discuss in a minute, a really weird thing to promote, Holy Holy, which I still can't get my head around. But yeah, I think one thing that people don't factor into it is that they were both very much enthralled to Syd Barrett, the original Pink Floyd frontman. And they probably hadn't realised until about 1969, 70, because they both separately referred to the fact that they never really met him, despite, you know, the public assumption is, oh, they must have been out taking LSD together all the time. But I think, didn't Bowie say something like, I only met him once or twice, he didn't seem that interested in talking to me? But so they wouldn't have known until about 1969, early 70, that, you know, something had gone very wrong with him, that he disappeared from Pink Floyd for good, and that he basically wasn't coming back. And
They would have known, though. I mean, like, Gilmore came in mid-68, didn't he? And he was definitely... When did Sourceful of Secrets come out?
You might have still thought there was capacity for, you know, a stellar Syd Barrett solo career, which, you know, there wasn't. There were two very strange albums, and then that was it. But there was a void to be filled there using kind of performance tools and style tools that people could no longer say, you've stolen from him. Because pop music was transient and it moved on. I think Bolan in particular seized on that. I mean, if you look at early photos of him, you know, sort of doing Ride the White Swan and so on, and you look at Syd Barrett 5 years earlier, there is not that much distance between them.
So, but him and Bowie, there was definitely a sort of competitive edge to their relationship, wasn't there? I mean, they were both scuffling around the mod scene in the late 60s, like we've discussed. They were both gunning for stardom. Something, I mean, I don't want to get too sidetracked, but something that we talked about in the 1960s podcast with Chris O'Leary also was, so Bowie was, you know, we look back and we see Bowie as being desperate for stardom and fame, but how did he envision that fame being? You know, did he just think it would be a springboard to a creative future where he could do whatever he wants in whatever field? Or did he see himself as just being a big, you know, a big pop star?
Well, it's kind of trying to figure out where the sea change in that came. I mean, to mention Pink Floyd again and Jimi Hendrix, I have this thing about both of their first albums are basically just 60s pop albums where they've been allowed to do a long instrumental on them. And, you know, they all turned up on, you know, the same sort of shows you would have got Herman's Hermits on. I think people didn't have until maybe the very late 60s when it was... became obvious. I think it changed with King Crimson personally when, you know, it becomes obvious you can have a massive career without any singles and without doing public appearances by having a very serious and weighty and worthy album. And before that, I think people weren't thinking much beyond, you know, their next single. Will that be successful? And obviously that was of great concern to Bowie because not many of his have been that successful.
I think that's definitely the case. We have to look at that time and, these bizarre combinations. I mean, there's that infamous tour with Hendrix supporting the Monkees, I think. And I think if you go through, you know, the history books, you'll find all sorts of bizarre things. Like King Crimson supporting Freddie and the Dreamers could well have happened. But also towards the end of the 60s, we started getting more television aimed at that older listener, you know, not just aimed at a generic ready, steady, go audience, but things like Late Night Lineup and all the rest of it, where music was treated with more respect and given the space to expand and develop. So, yeah, certainly the landscape was changing.
I mean, like you say, there were all these programmes starting to appear, like Disco 2, like Colour Me Pop, where Bowie did appear doing a mime on Colour Me Pop when his strobes were on. Yes, I think that no longer exists. I think they used to, Colour Me Pop, for anyone who doesn't know, was they had kind of proggy bands in studio. It's difficult to tell, but they appear to be live performances of their, you know, their numbers. And there will be a film section in the middle for presumably a number that's too difficult to do live. Like in the Small Faces one, it's Lazy Sunday, Bonzo Dog Doodah Bandits, Ryan the Kratic Oats, kind of things like that. But the Straubs had, I think it's called Poor Jimmy Wilson, and they got Bowie to do a mime on film for it. But none of these other shows until that Old Grey Whistle Test appearance, he shows up in, which is really weird. You'd think he'd be perfect fodder for all of that. There are rumours, and it's literally no more detailed than this. There was a pilot made by the department who made these shows sometime around 1970 that Bowie was involved in. But it's literally just that. It is a rumour. It's unsubstantiated. Nobody knows the title. Nobody knows what songs might have been involved. It may not even have existed. It may have just been, you know, a proposal on paper.
That's a very vague rumour.
But I would say, given his failure to appear anywhere else, there might be something in that rumour that he was at least thought about, because he is a glaring omission from all of those shows.
He really is.
Really quite strange.
Yeah. He's such a visual artist as well. I mean, we talk about the band, the Embryonic Spiders, which was, you know, obviously the hype before then, and how much attention they paid to their appearance. I mean, I don't know how valid this is to say, but I think Visconti's gone on record saying we were the first glam rock band, you know, in terms of visuals. And you look at those, I think there's a clip of them playing the Supermen. It was on one of those BBC 5 years documentaries. And they're there in their, you know, they each have a character. They, you know, are spangled and festooned in glitter and glam and skin tight Baco foil outfits, you know, the whole thing. And like you say, it's amazing that Bowie wasn't more visual. I mean, wasn't more seen at this point. But yeah, I guess, you know, having been the guy that did that funny space rocket record a couple of years back probably had something to do with that.
Well, maybe that's why they did the Love You Till Tuesday film, to try and fill that gap themselves.
Yeah, definitely.
That's the only reason I can think of for making that. I mean, where would it even have been shown? My only theory is that it may have been a supporting feature in cinemas had it got to a stage of release, but it doesn't appear that it was even submitted to the BBFC for certification.
Was it not?
It doesn't appear to be. I've never found a record of it being certified in the 60s, whereas other things, like, I mean, there is the recurring rumour that the Monkees film Head was never seen in the UK until Channel 4 showed it in the 80s, but it had the certificate in the 60s, so somebody must have shown it.
It would have been on in an all-night cinema or something, wouldn't it? Surely.
Oh, probably, but where did Love You Till Tuesday get shown? I've never been able to work out.
I mean, maybe it was conceived as being a TV. I mean, certainly the format and the content would indicate that, you know, it was Sunday afternoon extravaganza sort of thing. I've read that Ken Pitt banked so much on that being a success, having some kind of return. And yet, there was nowhere for it to be seen.
It's really weird as well, because I think it's incredibly well directed. It's not just a static camera.
Yeah.
While he does this, so there are different angles. Somebody has sat down and thought out, how do we show him in, you know, in conjunction with this lyric or this bit of the music? And it's so much more than people write it off as. Mm.
Can you imagine going to the cinema in 1969 or 1970 and being ready to watch some, I don't know, some big, dark, you know, Polanski epic or something, and then the little warm-up featurette beforehand was this bloke prancing around singing Rubber Band? I mean, you'd be baffled, wouldn't you?
Well, I always wonder that, you know, that there are credible reports of when he supported some bands in the late 60s that he did his mime before they came on. What must people have made of that?
What, the man trapped behind the glass wall thing?
Didn't they have routines of things like Please Mr. Gravedigger and so on?
I don't know.
What must people have what on earth did he mime to that? That's quite disturbing.
I think either Chris O'Leary or Nick Pegg said they'd heard rumours, and this could tie in with the rumours that you've heard, that was performed on Belgian TV or Dutch TV or something, and was, I think, just not shown because it was just too weird. Can you imagine?
You do surprise me.
Yeah. They'd have put like a darkened set and a little spotlight or something. It would have just been bizarre.
Well, don't really acknowledge what a, in some ways, distasteful song, especially for the time, please, Mr. Gravedigger. It astonishes me that DRAM vetoed the London Boys for the album and allowed that on, because it was like, what? Less than 6 months after the Moore's murders trial?
Yeah.
And it is inspired by that, despite what people might try to claim.
Oh, I think there's totally, you know, all the little beads and things like that. You know, it is really, really... I mean, wasn't that like Morrissey wrote as well in Suffer Little Children? You know, he refers little beads.
Well, Morrissey had heard Please, Mr. Gravedigger, let's be honest.
Okay, that's what happened. All these different things that he's trying out now that we're talking about, you know, the acting, the television, the drama, the music, the mime, you know, all these things are being flung out of his creative box. And he's just hoping and hoping and hoping that something sticks and it gives him that lifeline to get to where he wants to be. Now, Holy Holy was, as you say just now, a real watershed moment. So it was recorded 1970. Who was on the single? Yeah, Herbie Flowers.
Yeah,
credited as Blue Mink.
Yes, because Blue Mink were all session people, but they were quite a successful pop act for around 12 months. I mean, Melting Pot, Banner Man.
Didn't they
do Venus?
You don't
hear them as much now, but... No, that was Shocking Blue. Oh, I think I used to confuse them when I was younger. You know when... Because when this stuff was just named, I mean, one thing worth saying is, for years before I heard Holy Holy, it was a title in, I think, the Guinness Book of Rock Stars, which was, it had a kind of month-by-month detail of people's careers, and it just said single Holy Holy flops for that month in 1970. And I remember thinking, what is Holy Holy? Mm. Why have I never heard it? And you know, sometimes these things were just names, but yeah, obviously there was... Herbie Flowers, Alan Parker, who was a great session guitarist and keyboard player.
He was the one, obviously, who did that amazing guitar on Diamond Dogs, Alan Parker.
Yes, he was, yeah. Barry Morgan, who was a drummer, who drums on a lot of things around this time. So it wasn't like there wasn't musical muscle on this record, although it's got a weirdly... Now, I have a thing about, had this been a single by anyone else... It would be one of the most celebrated singles of the early 70s by now, because it is a bit of a mess, but it's just got such raw, punishing, accumulating power. I mean, the lyrics seem to be about black magic and Aleister Crowley, and the music befits that, just that growling start. That it's like the Jaws music a couple of years early. It really grabs your attention from the start, but I think it was a bit too chaotic for... I mean, what it really reminds me of, have you ever heard the single by The Move called Wild Tiger Woman?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard much by The Move, apart from the
obvious
hits.
Well, very few people have, because, you know, obviously they had all those massive hits in 66, 67. They were the biggest, and I think, you know, obviously, I imagine Bowie was a fan of them. But in the middle of all that, they had the single called Wild Tiger Woman, which I think was based on Have You Seen Your Mother, Baby by the Stones.
Yeah, yeah.
It's cacophonous. I mean, the lyrics do not bear repeating in polite society now, but it's this screeching sort of overloaded Hendrix-y thing where the drummer sings bits of the chorus because he's got such a low growling voice. And it bombed completely. It did not, the biggest band in the UK at that point, and it didn't chart.
Shall we listen to a bit of it? Saturday, can't see an ounce of reason in her head. Don't laugh and turn away. Wild, wild, wild tiger woman. Whoa, you move me very fast, but can it last another day? Get out of my way, wild, wild tiger woman. You never break it up all. They call it the wild tiger woman. I know, obviously, you know, Flowers in the Rain, Blackberry Way. Was it Bev Bevan who's the drummer?
Beth Bevan, yes, yeah, who's the one going wild, 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 wild in the choruses. Yeah.
Okay.
It's an extraordinary single, and Holy Holy really reminds me of that, which again, maybe you could point at Holy Holy and say, well, it's 5 years too late.
I'm just thinking now, you mentioned the intro and how it's everything's kind of jammed up against each other, isn't it? It's designed for impact.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of a little bit of something like I Want to Hold Your Hand, which was written for pure impact. You know, it was a song that was constructed to be pow. And yeah, there's definitely that here. So there's certainly a real sense of urgency to this.
The origins of the song are quite mysterious anyway, because I think, wasn't it recorded just after the Man Who Sold the World album sessions?
Yeah.
It's unfortunate that Black Country Rock, which is another attempt at emulating Mark Bolan, is the B-side, because there's something it's more like the first T-Rex album, the last Tyrannosaurus Rex album, than, you know, Hot Love or something. Mm. But it is very clearly Holy Holy is emulating what Bolan was starting to do when he went electric.
Ah.
And even the vocals are quite kind of, you know, they've got that warble in them.
He's definitely doing the warble on Black Country Rock. I hadn't discerned it so much here. But now,
it's more musical in Holy Holy than in the vocals, but I think it's very much informed by that.
Let's just talk about Crowley and that kind of HP Lovecraft and everything that was infusing the Man Who Sold the World period. I think Bowie mentioned later on that he was smoking tons of spliff and, you know, he was really getting into his occult, which was pretty voguish around that time, wasn't it? You had people like Jimmy Page as well, who were enthusiastically embracing the law of darkness.
Well, yeah, and it's an interesting flip side. From, you know, in the mid-60s, you got George Harrison exploring, you know, Eastern religions. What was the one Pink Floyd were interested in? Sant Mat.
Sid, well, that was Sid, wasn't it? Sid was apparently heartbroken when he was turned down to join, you know, the local Sant Mat chapter or whatever they called it in Cambridge.
But even Bowie, you've got, you know, Silly Boy Blue. I mean, again, it's debatable how serious he was about Buddhism.
he was,
it's steeped in it. Yeah, it's a positive religion. And a couple of years later, it's all about black magic and the black arts. And I have some more rational theories about that. I think for some of them, naming no names, Crowley, whatever we're calling him today, it's a bit Bowie, isn't it? Which is another interesting analogy, but he gave legitimacy and an excuse to some things they were interested in doing. That's I will leave it there, but I suspect that was more the motivation of some of them than, you know, an actual interest in teachings, I suppose.
I think you're right. I think, oh, well, he says it's all right, so I can be a Buddhist and, you know, sacrifice this person at dawn as well, so I'll do that. But it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I think he was genuinely smitten with Buddhism till his death.
Well, didn't he, around the time of when he was considering Old Song to bring back for Toy, didn't he put a Buddhist chant in the middle of City Boy Blue?
I can't remember. Did he?
In live performances. I believe so. Yes. Yeah.
I'll have to check that out. I don't know.
And obviously, you know, you've got things like Looking for Satellites has got kind of a Buddhist mantra intro, which unfortunately mentions Boyzone, which, you know, takes you out of your devotionism a little. But
Buddhism and Boyzone. That's Bowie for you.
Yeah.
But I think definitely the Buddhism was strong in the late 60s, wasn't it? I mean, what's the name of that monk he befriended, something, who was apparently...
I get him mixed up with Campo from Doctor Who and the Planet of the Spiders, so let's not even go there. He's got a very similar name.
Let's say very influential Buddhist monk.
But, you know, Buddhism in Doctor Who, you know, they have black magic and the demons as well, so all of this stuff was in the air.
This is something that has always really interested me, this Bowie album-to-album podcast and the Doctor Who crossover. I know nothing about Doctor Who. I've just never been a Whovian. But then there are people like yourself and Nick Pegg who are steeped, obviously, in the mythology of Doctor Who. And it's really fascinating just to see how these worlds combine.
Well, I think it's because, you know, I don't think you can draw parallel lines and say, you know, oh, Bowie must have been watching, I don't know, Death of the Daleks or whatever. But I think it more indicates how prevalent these things were. I mean, apparently there are actually references to him having watched this at Haddon Hall. But the story from 1970 called The Silurians, which has got a very kind of weird early music score.
Yeah.
and which Bowie didn't really go in for, but there were a lot of people around that time trying to bring early music into the mainstream. And there's a guy called David Munro who did the soundtracks for things like Ken Russell's The Devils and Elizabeth R and things like that, who was very keen on, I think he had the kids program on Radio 3 where he told kind of like kids, you know, folk tales and so on, using early instruments. It was a brief thing around then. And I think the crossover between Bowie and Doctor Who, where they were just reflecting what was briefly, voguishly in the air around then. And I think that's probably the case here. You know, I don't think he saw the demons and thought, oh, I should study this this dark arts thing.
Is there anything around this time you think, oh yeah, that could well have indicated that, you know, he'd seen a particular episode or something?
I would say, and I've got two friends who can train spot about Bowie even more than I can. And in turn, they love to tell people that they know someone who actually prefers the 60s stuff to the later stuff, and nobody believes them. But we all agree that the most Bowie series of Doctor Who was in 1971, which is, it's, you know, due to very tedious reasons, due to strikes and less money being available because the BBC had just gone into full colour and so on. But you've got these very long, drawn-out stories about quite proggy concerns, you know, ecological concerns and so on. And that was the series the Silurians was in, which apparently there is some evidence he did actually see. And it's just more a tying together thing, really.
Okay. Interesting, the Bowie Who connection, I'm sure. We'll
and also, people regard the Sylvester McCoy era in much the same way as they do Tim Machine. My stance is that I like both. So, yeah.
Sylvester McCoy, the Tin Machine of Time Lords. That's perfect. Okay, so back to Holy Holy, and we were talking about the lineup. As you mentioned, this was recorded in, the first version was recorded in November 1970, just off the back of The Man Who Sold the World. And yet he's using a different lineup for this. He's not using the core of musicians who were on the album, namely, obviously, the Embryonic Spiders, Mick Ronson in particular.
Yeah, apparently it was Tony DeFries, one of his first decisions was to basically say, you know, this guy in Blue Mink is doing quite well. Why not get him to produce it and get all his session men mates on? So I don't think it was Bowie himself really picked them out. But again, you know, that's still trying to throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks. And this is really the last time. I mean, he did it artistically later on. You know, for heaven's sake, he did the drum and bass album, you know, and so forth. But this is the last time it was trying to see what would catch on with the public rather than what would catch on artistically. It absolutely did not work.
The process of recording The Man Who Sold the World was so much directed by Visconti and Ronson. Bowie very famously wasn't exactly, you know, sort of that present in the early stages of the recording, and Bowie would come in at the last minute and scribble lyrics and sing them. That's what Visconti said, but it's even more intriguing in the light of that, that then he turns around completely to use Herbie Flowers and a different lineup, more or less, to record this single, which was recorded, I believe, because executives at Mercury thought, well, where's the single on this album? And of course, looking back at it now, you just say, well, are you kidding? I mean, you've got the title track, you could do Black Country Rock, you know, you could do an edit of Width of a Circle, whatever.
I was just about to say that. That would have worked.
That would have been great. I mean, you listen to those edits that Visconti made in the mid-70s to varying degrees of success, you know, where he would chop the middle out of Young Americans or just slice a bit off Ashes to Ashes and come up with a chart-topping single. It's amazing then that these executives are like, no, we've got to send you back in the studio to record a single for us. And this is what he comes up with.
Well, and I can't see why they thought it would be a hit. I mean, one of my things about this is that had it been by some mysterious band from the Midlands that nobody knew anything about now, they just knew the name and the name of maybe the bass player who went on to be in another band, it would be more revered than it is. It would go for a lot more money than weirdly Holy Holy actually does. It would be on one of those Bob Stanley and Pete Wiggs compilations, you know, the early 70s prog ones. It really, really would.
What do you think they'd have chosen for the cover of that compilation? Do you think it would have been maybe a couple of Dolly Birds sitting in the back of a Ford Capri outside of Woolworths in a Warwickshire High Street? I don't know why that just came to me.
I don't know, I would have thought it would be more Black Magic, even. A box of Black Magic, that's
box
what it
would
have
been. Box of Black Magic, yeah. So it would have, you reckon it would have been, it would have gained far more recognition had it been a one-off, one-hit wonder by the band that, you know, Dave Bloggs then was once in.
In retrospect, I think it would have been. I mean, it wasn't like they didn't pull out the stops at the time. I mean, I'm assured by, you know, Rob Chapman, who knows his stuff, that it was played quite heavily on Radio Luxembourg in particular. And, you know, there was a big PR campaign behind it. He performed it on Granada TV's Newsday. Amazes
wearing
me
a
to
dress,
this day.
Wikipedia tells me.
Yes, yeah,
wearing
yeah. And there
dress.
Are photos of that existing. I have tried to track down to see if, you know, because things do crawl out of the woodwork in the Granada archive, because they were generally quite meticulous about keeping things. It just, they turn out to be filed under a different name. Like, for years, nobody knew what had happened to Stone Roses' performance of Granada reports. And then it turned out, you know, they hadn't labelled it. The Stone Roses are on it. It was just Granada reports.
When was
and
that
then somebody
from?
Did track it down. That was from 1989 in the Chibangs drums. And, you know, it is possible that somewhere, this performance is still sitting out there. I'm just, as somebody who grew up in the Granada region and, you know, was aware that they always championed, it tended to be local bands, but, you know, because they were the only people that come on Granada reports. It's like Factory Records bands or The Lars or In Spiral Carpets or people like that. Always interviewed by, and I think he might have interviewed Bowie here, with a chap called Bob Greaves, who was an older presenter. Mm. But he was given all the arts gigs because he did his best to try and understand and follow what these young upstarts were doing. And you compare it to, you know, just a couple of years later, the Sex Pistols' Bill Grundy, he's got no interest in what they're doing, and that's where all that kicks off from. And I imagine if he chatted to Bob Greaves about this new single, he might have been a bit more disarmed than usual about, you know, his recent lack of success. I mean, who knows, because we don't have it to watch.
That's very much a trait of Bowie's, that you see him. If you've, you know, if you've watched as much Bowie interviews as we have, you see him, how he responds to different types of interviewers. So there'll be those who he doesn't respond so well to. And I'm thinking of you, Terry Wogan, Tin Machine.
And then it's my lunch, Terry.
And then, of course, there are those that he really opens up to. And it sounds like the more genuine and sincere the interviewer is in admitting that he doesn't really know much about this pop business, but he's very intrigued in what he's doing, Bowie would have probably done his very polite schoolboy visiting his friend's parents' voice up for Sunday lunch, even though he's wearing the dress that would have been on the cover of the Man Who Sold the World.
Well, I was going to say, on Granada's news shows, they would not have batted an eye at a man wearing a dress.
Really?
Well, you hear stories about how nice, I mean, it was difficult to get to him, but how nice Bowie was to people who encountered him. I mean, there's that guy who was on Adam Buxton's podcast.
Oh, the Irish guy.
He befriended Bowie through the Bowie net for him. You know, that sort of thing really warms your heart, that.
I think it's one of the things I love about Bowie, especially in his later years, when you hear interviews with him, genuinely, I think, just a lovely bloke.
Absolutely, and I think it's quite key that, I mean, on Looks Unfamiliar recently, one of the guests, David Smith, chose Bandslam, which is a teen film that was David Bowie's last film appearance, which, you know, I'll admit, I hadn't actually seen until I had to watch it for the podcast.
When's that but from?
That's from the mid-2000s, I think.
Blimey, I've never even heard of that.
It didn't really take off, but I mean, Nick Pegg reviews it in the book and says it's a, you know, it's a wonderful film. And it really is. It's really, really good. But we got talking about the fact that was during his quiet time.
Yeah.
And I think it's key that there was that interview where somebody asked him, "Mom, what's it like being married to David Bowie?" And she said, "I don't know, I'm married to David Jones." And like I say, I think that was reflected in, I mean, it was prompted by health concerns and so on, but what he did around that time, he did go back to the sort of interest he had in the 60s when he was David Jones, you know, going to galleries and so on, checking out this small-scale jazz band that later turned up performing on Black Star, you know, all kinds of things like that. And to do those things, you have to be in touch with real people.
Yeah.
And not rub them up the wrong way, because there would have been stories about David Bowie came into my gallery and he was horrible to me. Now, nothing like that came out.
It's very telling, isn't it? That period that you're talking about, though, those fallow, you know, those quiet, I was going to say fallow years, but those quiet years, and obviously health concerns since 2004, and then just the stepping back, it must have been, I really wish there was some way we could get to know, maybe in years to come, a little bit about his life during that time, because, yeah, he was David Jones again. Which he hadn't been since the mid-60s.
That must have felt so liberating, even more than Tin Machine did. you know, because he was writing...
That's a pretty high bar, though, to be honest, Tim. I mean, like, you know, more liberating than Tim Machine? I mean, come on.
Oh, come on. Who wouldn't enjoy turning their back on the stadium career to make some noise with Reeves Cabrels in the studio?
I think I really should just rename you Tim Machine now.
And, yes!
But he had this wonderful period where, unlike the David Jones of the 1960s, he'd made it. He was top of the pile. He had the respect of his peers. He had a wonderful artistic canon behind him. He had a beautiful wife and daughter he was madly in love with. I mean, to all intents and purposes, he was incredibly content and happy. I mean, he had health problems. He was getting older. So go back to what we're talking about. Being so secure in himself that he was quite happy to send himself up on extras or be on SpongeBob SquarePants or do Band Slam. What a great place to be. You couldn't imagine Jagger doing that, could you?
Well, I think that reflects on the reappearance of Holy Holy, which, you know, was the mysterious, fittingly mysterious part of his discography for a long, long time. I mean, let's sort of just get the weird history of it out of the way. It came out as a single, re-recorded with the Spiders in a version that I don't like as much because it is just like any other Ziggy song.
Really?
Yeah, it doesn't have the same kind of, like, fascination for me as the original does.
Right.
But then it disappears.
Okay.
It's not on reissues of The Man Who Sold the World. It's not on any compilations. There are rumours that the master tape went astray. And nobody's quite got to the bottom of it. But then when you get to the early 90s, the Ryker Disc CDs.
Mm. Fantastic.
The back
collection
of The Man Who Sold the World says that the original single version of Holy Holy's on there. It's the Spiders version.
Yeah, yeah.
And that still rankles with me. You know, CDs were a luxury still in those days. You had to save up to get them.
Yeah.
And it didn't deliver what it promised. That still annoys me a bit now. And Holy Holy just consistently failed the original to reappear after that. I mean, that was one of the occasions I did not feel guilty about downloading something from Napster. I was finally getting hold of the original Holy Holy. I thought, well, they're not letting me buy it.
I won't care. Be silenced.
Yeah. It was shortly before he died, wasn't it? It turned up on the 5 years box set. Now, there's some debate about, some people think it's a vinyl rip, an original single. I'm not so sure because I like to think I can usually tell when things have been mastered from vinyl. If that was mastered from vinyl, it's a single that's been kept in optimal condition since 1971. Exactly, yeah. But it's difficult to tell. But the fact that it was allowed back out, and you know, people might say, oh, well, you know, the box sets have everything that was released on them. They don't. Some stuff hasn't reappeared. They should have done. I mean, the obvious one is Too Dizzy on the 80s box set, which, you know, is no great loss. But, you know, there was still clearly some editing judgment going on. And Holy Holy had been considered for some reason, whether it was due to missing tape, whether it was just bad memories or whatever, it'd be the pariah for a long time. I mean, you think of what you could, how many copies you could have shifted of, say, what was the 1990 compilation called? But if
Sound
you put includes rare... Well, actually, Sound of Vision, yeah, but I was thinking of the single disc one.
Changes Bowie.
Yeah, if you put on that, you know, includes rare single not heard since 1971. Imagine how many more copies that would have sold, but they didn't. But they finally relent with this. And maybe that's to do with a kind of contentment for his past. I mean, you know, there's still some things like the 60s stuff is still out in the cold a bit. We've yet to see what's going to happen with Tin Machine, really. I mean, I know Tin Machine 2's back out, you know, thanks to long-standing pressure from some of us, might add as well. But, you know, I do think there's been more of a welcoming attitude to some of the kind of shut-off corners of his back. Look, I mean, the Absolute Beginner soundtrack's back out, and all three of those tracks were on one of the box sets.
True.
I don't think Valore was remembered with, you know, particularly great affection, but it's nice to have it again.
It's nice to have it again, but to what extent do you think this comes down to just mundane licensing rights, that sort of thing?
I think it's going to be a mixture of things. I mean, I am somebody who knows a lot about lost television and radio from the 60s, and quite often, when these things turn out to exist, the effort that's been involved in finding them is gargantuan. I mean, it's quite possible that the tape for Holy Holy had been there all along, but it's just whoever owned Mercury by that point. In fact, maybe it wasn't sold to RCA with The Man Who Sold the World. That's an interesting additional consideration. But, you know, it could just be that a request landed on somebody's desk and they thought, you know, I can't really be bothered. It's like you hear about things like I know both Blur and My Bloody Valentine, when they did reissues of their stuff a couple of years ago, had to really fight to be allowed near the actual original master tapes.
I can imagine My Bloody Valentine.
Because they
I
were just being offered third-gen dubs or whatever. And like, no, we want the masters. We want to do it properly.
Can you imagine telling Kevin Shields he can't have the master tapes? Can you imagine being that person who would have to tell Kevin Shields he can't have those masters? Sorry. Sorry, Kevin, you can't. I mean, you would fear for your life, wouldn't you? You'd have to move into a witness protection program. With Holy Holy, having this great lost single is remarkable, because not only does he revisit it a couple of years later, but the kind of that post-Ziggy boom, surely, you know, any record executive who's sitting on unreleased material would have, as they did with all the 60s stuff, would be rushing to repackage, reissue, re-release with a contemporary cover, wouldn't they? So that's even more intriguing that that original cut just seemed to slip through the cracks. Maybe the thinking was, now that Bowie's redone the track, this is now canon. You know, like the previous version, we're just gonna, it's gonna be a bit Arnold Korns. You know, it's just gonna
and
be...
also it's apparently only ever in mono, which possibly didn't help.
I mean, Madness of the World was cut all in stereo. Why was this just done? Very weird. Why do you think Woody Woodmansey and his band chose this as the title, as the name of their band?
I'm not sure, because the two times I've seen them, they've not actually performed it.
Yeah, they don't.
Which is a bit, I mean, don't get me wrong, I think they were thinking of the Spiders version. I don't think it was any long-standing affection for the original single. But, I mean, I'm just thrilled that they chose that name. I think it's... Although the kind of repertoire goes all over the place, I think it is pointing to that exciting time in his career when things were starting to happen. And it's like, I would compare it to Brian May always says about the time he was happiest in his life was, you know, when he was doing his PhD during the day and then rehearsing with this new band at night and thinking, this is going to go somewhere.
Yeah.
And imagine the excitement when things finally start moving for Bowie. You know, a couple of months after Holy Holy had flopped. You know, and how much ancient history it must have seemed by the time, you know, Hunky Dory started getting really positive reviews. You know, which the tenor of them is basically, this is the record he always talked like he could make.
Absolutely.
Which is, you know, it, and to use a really bad analogy, maybe he'd just been talking without thinking previously. You know, Holy Holy, I love it, but it's got the air of somebody just thinking, oh yeah, I need a single, what have I got?
Yeah,
that'll
do.
You know, there isn't really a strategy behind it, whereas there was with Hunky Dory. You know, and that's an immediate switch over point, I think.
You mentioned Brian May, and definitely in the Spiders remake of it, there is that. Don't you feel there's a bit of Brian May going on there in Mick Ronson's guitar? I don't know how close they were.
There is actually, yes, yeah.
It's definitely got a bit of Queen going on. You could imagine Freddie doing that.
I wonder if he ever did.
I wonder if he ever did.
We'll never know.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. But Tim Machine Worthington.
I'll stick with that rather than TV's Quangas expert now.
Can you add that to your bio now?
Yeah.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, sir. If you still want more wonderful things, and all things Tim Machine Worthington related, are available at Tim, where can we find more of your things?
TimWorthington.org is the best place. There are a couple of Bowie-related features on there. And if you're really interested in one of my published anthologies, Can't Help Thinking About Me, there's quite a few Bowie-related pieces, including on the two times I saw him live, which were on the Tin Machine 2 and Earthling tours. There's a big feature trying to work out what happened in his early TV appearances, which, you know, were all lost. So
it is really...
Yeah, that's the place to go.
I have Can't Help Thinking About Me. I have Higher Than the Sun, which is your book about Primal Scream, My Bloody Valentine, Saint Etienne. I forgot the
Teenage Fan Club.
Teenage Fan Club. Well, I'll stick to Can't Help Thinking About Me. But I have Can't Help Thinking About Me, and it's an absolutely fascinating read. And again, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, it's you taking a fresh sort of, I don't want to say a sideways look at things, because that's the worst cliche of all cliches, but it is a really refreshing and fascinating read. So I do recommend that for anyone who's interested in the more esoteric ends of Bowie's career. So with that, Tim, thank you again. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope to welcome you back soon. And no doubt, Tim Machine Worthington will. I wonder what you can guess what we'll be talking about next. But we'll definitely be talking about something next.
It'll be absolute beginners.
It's Bellare. Okay, well, thanks, Tim.
That was me sitting down with the stand-up guy, Tim Machine Worthington. And as we mentioned, his site at timworthington.org has details in profusion about his numerous activities and interests, and is well worth a rummage around in. In the meantime, as ever, I hope you enjoyed our chat, and please do review and share this podcast if you have. It's very much appreciated, as are all the comments and messages on social media. So until the next episode, stay safe and well, and thank you for listening to Album to Album.